Hi, this is Faith Mitchell, President of Grantmakers in Health. I'd like to welcome you to the latest edition in GIH's podcast series. Our goal is to provide you with an insider's view of what's happening on the front lines of health by hearing from leaders in the field. I hope you enjoy these podcasts and find them insightful as you lead your philanthropic work. This year, Grantmakers in Health is celebrating 35 years of supporting better health through better philanthropy. Since our founding, we've grown into the largest national network dedicated to meeting the needs and concerns of health funders. We're marking this organizational milestone in several ways, including a podcast series called Fresh Perspectives, Voices from the Field. Tim McHugh is the first in the series. No pressure, Tim. And I'm looking forward to talking with him about his top-of-mind issues, career path, vision for the future, and anything else we want to chat about. So, let's get started. To begin with, Tim, can you introduce yourself and tell us more about the Potomac Health Foundation and your role there?
Well, good afternoon, Faith, and thank you so much for inviting me to this opportunity. And congratulations to all of our friends and colleagues and peers at Grantmakers in Health. 35 years is a long time, and you've done a lot of great work and looking forward to the future for the organization and for the field. Again, I'm Timothy McHugh. I'm the Director of Grant Programs at the Potomac Health Foundation. We are located in Woodbridge, Virginia, which is in Prince William County, just about 20 miles south of Washington, D.C. We're part of the D.C. metropolitan area. At the foundation, we just wrapped up a strategic planning process, and we focus on three areas: access to health, mental and behavioral health, and capacity building. We'll be rolling out grant-making programs in the next 18 months or so on those three areas of interest. And this was a very long process for us. We spent about a year and a half on an evaluation plan, a strategic plan, and then a deep dive assessment on those three topics. And we're looking forward to really shaking things up in our local community. It's a rapidly changing, diversifying community. And it's a hyper-local foundation. We focus on 12 zip codes in the portion of the county that we serve. And it's a, again, rapidly changing community. Lots of immigration in Hispanic and Latino communities. As D.C. gentrifies, the population is moving south into Virginia and north into Maryland. So we're seeing a big population and cultural shift in the county, which is helping and impeding some of our work, both good and bad.
Great. Couple questions that come to mind. So one is, have you shared the details of the new strategic plan with the communities you serve? And if so, what kind of reaction have you gotten from them? And then second, is the new plan related to your efforts to be effective? You and I were talking a little while ago about effective philanthropy. So I'm curious how those things connect and how the foundation sees itself improving its effectiveness in the months and years to come.
We will be rolling out in the fall through an annual report and communications plan, more of the nitty-gritty details around the grant-making program and the new strategic vision for the foundation. We have had one grant-making cycle this fall that will impede some of that, and we'll start to actually see some of the changes trickle out into our existing network of grantees. We used to be a very broad foundation grant-making-wise. We had everything from human trafficking prevention work in the Prince William County schools to permanent supportive housing work to some homeless supportive services and training people how to do CPR. And it was almost too broad of a focus for such a hyper-local foundation that we were still not able to truly identify the impact and the effectiveness of our grant-making that we were having on the community. So the board wanted to pare that back a little bit to be able to see what we actually were achieving. And we think that focusing on these three, again, access to health, mental and behavioral health, and capacity building will allow us to see that impact that we're having.
Have you gotten any pushback from the folks who are left behind by the new strategic plan?
Not so much. We will try to find some opportunities for either the programs that have been historically successful within our portfolio and or the agencies. And I myself see some agencies that may have used to play X role over here to play a slightly different role in our new grant-making program to be more effective and have a larger and more deeper impact on the communities that they're serving.
Are you the major funder in your area, or are there other foundations?
I would say that we're probably the largest. Prince William County does have some grant-making opportunities through the county dollars. And there are several D.C. area foundations and corporate entities that give in Prince William County and as well as across Northern Virginia. But I would say in Prince William County specifically, we are probably the largest entity, especially funding directly in health.
One of the reasons I ask that is that As you know well, there are many, many local funders who are part of GIH, and we often hear the concern that as one of the biggest players in town, sometimes the only funder in a community, that it's really hard to set priorities because automatically you're ruling some grantees or efforts out as you, you know, support other ones. How do you deal with that tension of knowing that if you set priorities, not every need in the community is going to be addressed?
Well, this was a very thoughtful process for the foundation. We started off with an evaluation plan looking at the past 7 or so years of grant making that we had been doing. What was achieved? What was occurring? What were some of the missed opportunities throughout that period? We then led into a strategic planning process, which most of our board has been involved in Prince William County and across the region for the 30 so years that the Potomac Hospital, which was where the foundation was formed by the sale that when Sentara purchased it. So they know the community, they know the players, they know kind of the need of the community. And then through the planning process, as well as this deep dive assessment, we had focus groups. We brought our grantees together. We talked to our fellow funders and peer organizations across the region to see kind of the direction that they were going. We looked at an abundance of data and reports and outcomes in the Virginia Commonwealth Plan for Health and such. In these processes, you are always going to leave somebody out. And I think that the real challenge and opportunity is not everybody moving forward has to do the same work that they've been doing. Maybe there's a different role or an additional role that they could play. You know, every nonprofit wants to close ultimately. And sometimes that doesn't mean that an organization itself has to close, but maybe a program or a service has to sunset and become something more to respond to the community need. I'm in this work to serve the community as a whole, not just my grantees. And I always think that I live in these communities. I live in Alexandria, Virginia, just a little bit north from where I work. And I think, what are the services that I would need? What are the amenities if I was raising a family in this region, this community, that I would want at my disposal?
Tim, I'm thinking about your very well-received annual conference session on Thriving Through Disruption. And as we celebrate this 35th anniversary of GIH, we're thinking about the future, and that session addressed how funders can move into the future, and I'd love to hear more of your thoughts on that topic.
We were tickled pink, all three of our panelists, Susie Lee from the Potomac Health Foundation, Dan Cohn from the Mount Sinai Healthcare Foundation in Cleveland, and Alicia Collins from the Reebok Foundation. We were just ecstatic with the turnout. I looked up for answering questions at one point, and there was probably 30, 35 people in the room. And I think that there's a real energy to start a conversation, not only within and across Grantmakers in Health, but across the field as a whole, to look to the next generation of leadership, and not even age-wise, but people that have come from other fields, people that have come from government, people that have come from corporate America, people that have moved across the country. I just moved from Northeast Ohio. I spent most of my career in Cleveland, and I brought with me to the DC metro area a set of new ideas and experiences from what grant-making and philanthropy was like in the community that I used to live. I always think that there's no reason to reinvent the wheel. I know that there are fellow suburban funders in Minneapolis or Los Angeles or Chicagoland that are having the same struggles and the same questions that I am finding myself tackling at the Potomac Health Foundation. And for us to be able to work together to kind of shake up the snow globe and try things a little differently, especially if someone else has already tried that in a similar community, those are where the opportunities are.
So what does disruption look like? Can you give me some examples?
Disruption, for me, it is challenging status quo. Philanthropy often is a very slow-moving process. These conversations last a long time. Boards are slow to change. And I think that offering pause and offering recognition of the contributions and investments that individual philanthropists and foundations and corporations have made across topics, across communities, in neighborhoods, whatever the case may be, but recognize the opportunity and some of the missed opportunities that have fallen by the wayside. That's disruption. And it's, again, honoring and respecting the past and the persons that have forged the path to lead the way to where we are all today. But I often think to myself, I've been in the field in some grant-making opportunity since 2004 when I first worked at St. Luke's Foundation in Cleveland, Ohio. And I think to myself, in Cleveland or in the suburbs here in DC where I've worked even before the Potomac Health Foundation, what has changed and who were we failing along the way and who's being left behind? And sometimes that keeps me up at night because I know that I too may have been contributing to the problem that I also now want to disrupt.
People often, program staff, often observe that trustees are the most conservative voice at the foundation. So how do you prepare them for disruption or get them to go along with it? Have you been able to do that at Potomac Health?
For instance, we knew that we wanted to move more towards including, as we could, advocacy and policy work within our grant-making portfolio. There are great agencies out of Richmond and Washington, D.C. that are leading those charges and leading those conversations. So we reached out to colleagues in foundations across the region that had been doing that work and making those types of investments. And we actually brought in some education to our board to teach them about advocacy. We were knocking down very rampant and very popular urban beliefs about what foundations can and cannot do around advocacy and policy. And our guest speaker at a recent board meeting just laid it out on the table for our board and said, this is not true. You can do this. You can fund this. You'll be well within the IRS regulations and federal policy. And we were able to get through two or three of those grants that were in proposal at that stage. And they just started their work on July 1st.
How long did that whole process take? I'm curious because this is a conversation we often have at GIH. How do I get my trustees on board with insert the topic there? So I'm curious in your experience.
Susie and I, that's our executive director, we started conversations with the grantees that we were kind of eyeing for these opportunities right after the first of the year to say, you know, would you even be interested in being a Potomac Health Foundation grantee? Would you even be working and advocating for the communities and the zip codes and whatnot that we serve and the issues that the foundation funds in? And when we saw who those agencies may be, we kind of saw a vision for where this needed to go and the training and the education that the board needed around those topics. The board education happened in the spring, and the grant making actually occurred in the June meeting, so the very starts of summer.
So it was a pretty quick process.
Yes, and we were, knocking wood, fortunate that it actually passed, because sometimes you just have those conversations and the grants actually don't go through. But I think as long as you move the needle with the board and you introduce new information to them, you're, again, disrupting kind of their familiar thought patterns and misconceptions.
Tim, one of the things that we're really interested in hearing from younger foundation staff is where they see philanthropy going. You don't have to limit your ideas to what you do currently at Potomac Health, but when you draw on your years of experience as a health grant maker and all of your conversations with your peers and so forth, and if you could do anything, what would you do?
I would take a step back and first assess, are we even going in a direction as a field as a whole? What is that direction and what kind of ideas and opportunities in divergence in that path are we ready to take? And with what kind of ambition and challenge in kind of unknown terrain? I think that philanthropy has been formulaic for a very long time. You can go to one foundation and pretty easily replicate that formula and prescriptive nature of the way that that grant-making body passes out those dollars to the community all across the country. I think about President Trump and the way he says, make America great again. There have been foundations that have been giving out money for decades. And at the same time, nothing's really changed in some of those cities and neighborhoods. And sometimes, in some sad cases, it may have even gotten worse. And I think for philanthropy to be able to pause and say, wow, we had a hand in that and it didn't turn out so great. What can we do differently? What can we do better? Who can we work with and bring to the table? I think when I was grant making in Ohio and had a little bit of opportunity to travel across the country to do site visits and whatnot, I was always taken aback by the number of nonprofits that would say to me, you want a client at our site visit? You want a client during that tour to speak with? And I would always say to them, who knows better than the persons that you're serving to tell the story about the agency and the opportunities and what I, as a grant-making and a foundation professional, should be investing in. And very rarely do we see at Grantmakers and Health events or podcasts or many of the other affinity groups or local regional associations for foundations, do we see clients and community members involved on panels or being featured in a podcast? And I think that very rarely the federal government often has requirements for client representation on boards or committees. It's a very slow trend for foundations to get on that bandwagon and to have that voice and perspective in their grant-making bodies or committees advising the foundations. You know, looking at my past experience, I've been a consumer of health nonprofits and social service and human service programs. I grew up in very middle-class Pittsburgh. My father was on strike and we had to use assistance programs and whatnot over the years. And I try to bring an empathy and a sympathy to the conversation. And oftentimes, I don't think that even if a foundation professional has that experience, is it welcomed or invited and encouraged to share that opportunity at the table? Going back to the Thriving Through Disruption session at the conference, one of the panelists, Alicia Collins, you know, she spoke about her family history and personal experience within the nonprofit community and how that informs her experience in her role as a grant maker. And how she's pushing buttons to say, no, that's not exactly how that works to her board or peers. And I think that we as a field need to have those checks and balances and honest conversations a little bit more often than what we do.
I agree with you. It shouldn't be a radical notion. It should be part of doing the work. One of the things that you said a few minutes ago that I picked up on was the formulaic nature of a lot of grant making. That's something I've been reflecting on a lot lately. When I started in philanthropy 30 years ago, there were many fewer foundations than there are now, and most of them were private, meaning it was before the rise of the conversion foundations. And being private, they were associated with specific founders, usually many of whom were still alive. In those old days, there were not a lot of intermediary organizations, you know, consultants that worked closely with philanthropy. And in the 30 years since then, that's become a thriving industry. I often wonder if those consultants are responsible in some respects for the formulaic nature of much of the grant making we see, because they kind of sell a point of view or almost like a packaged strategy to many of their clients. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or experience with that.
With no disrespect to the consulting firms and individual consultants that I know, call friends and colleagues across the country who are all doing great work, I'll preface it with that. At the end of the day, let's say maybe 25 go-to names, go-to firms and persons that are leading these projects across the country. And I think that the point that you made, where they're are kind of a slice and dice pre-cut recipe that they take across the country, across the state, across the community, has led to the problem. But I also think that to break into that field is very challenging. A lot of the foundation teams, remember that we are nonprofits. Many foundations have nonprofit level pays. Someone that has 10 years or so of experience, they don't have the personal capital to become a consultant and influx a new set of ideas or a new program, a new model. And then even when those opportunities that the larger firms do come open, they're very competitive processes. So I think that the consultant community has to think differently about where they source their ideas from, who they are kind of Robin Hooding concepts from, you know, stealing from the rich and giving to the poor, idea-wise. And I think that GIH can play a role in that by offering sessions at conferences or webinar opportunities to those rising voices, to those out-of-the-box practices and program models at individual nonprofits or foundations across the country that may not have the scope and the voice and the platform that some of the larger or more well-known community foundations or corporate foundations or private foundations often have.
I often err by making blanket criticisms. And there's no question that consulting firms are a benefit, especially to small funders. who are often challenged in terms of staff size and their ability to find out what's going on in the rest of the country. It's just that I see there's a potential downside as well. And I love your idea of what GIH can do to introduce new voices into the mix and new perspectives. We actually try very hard with our annual conference process to make sure that it isn't just the same funders every year round, and to bring new voices and new ideas to the conversation. And we rely on people like you for additional suggestions about how to do that, so that we don't get just standardization that is insensitive to grant-making realities in communities.
I encourage individuals, when they see these RFPs for sessions and proposals for conferences and such, to submit them. Even if you've never attended that conference, even if you aren't quite certain what it's going to look like at the end of the day when you're actually delivering that presentation or that panel conversation, try it out, because you don't know. Maybe there is an idea. Maybe there's a kernel that could be combined with another session that's also being proposed and really enhance the conversation and raise all ships for those dialogues that need to really occur.
Speaking of GIH's role, another idea that you raised up a few minutes ago that I liked was when you said there's not just one future for health philanthropy. There are many future directions. That's very helpful for us, because so often the field gets talked about as though it's marching in lockstep towards some destination. And I think it's really important for us as an organization that's working with the field to remember, in fact, there are multiple directions. And we need to be sensitive, paying attention to what those directions are and keeping the connections going. And I wonder if you have any more thoughts about the different directions in which health philanthropy is going.
I think that it's a challenging but welcome opportunity for GIH. I think that you yourself, Faith, are always first to say at events and webinars that you're a nonpartisan entity, and you have membership that are reflective of all walks of life, all sides of the aisle, from all across the country. From my personal experience, a lot of, especially Health Conversion Foundation staff, are more progressive. They were supporters of Obamacare. I think we can assume the sides of the aisle, red or blue, they may sit. For myself, I think about my beliefs may not always match the grantee's belief or the clients at that organization that I am funding. And also that my peer colleagues from across the country that I see at these conferences and are sitting on these webinars and such with, that they're funding in deeply red states or deeply blue states and serving a very unique community and population. I think about, you know, friends that are funding in West Virginia or Arkansas or Missouri or Hawaii. There are unique cultural opportunities, unique political realities, just as our friends down the street in the House, in the Senate, need to recognize and work bipartisan. We need to find ideas and solutions. At the end of the day, we want people to have healthier, happier, more productive lives and move them out of these burdens in realities that they find themselves in. And for me, we don't do that with one party's ideas. We don't do that with one example or a project that worked in New York City or California or Florida. May not work in Washington, D.C., or may not work in Virginia, or may not work in Kansas. But to find those opportunities that can be mimicked or just tweaked a little bit, and find the good and the bad in how we leverage funds. You know, some of the work that you did last year with SAMHSA, bringing us together with the regional leadership from that organization, was really beneficial. And I think cracked a door to conversations and expertise in what those federal agencies can even information-wise provide the local funders in those communities. I myself have followed up with some of the people that I've met at that conversation that you had last year.
Capturing the diversity of views in health and health philanthropy is an ongoing challenge for us, and I have enjoyed talking to you about that in the past and your sensitivity to that, because we know, as you said, that there are a variety of views about how to serve the health of the people, but that for GIH in particular, because we're often perceived as being a quote-unquote liberal organization, the more conservative voices maybe feel almost like shy about speaking up. I know that I personally would welcome hearing from all sides. Now, we do have people who will literally write me sometimes with when, say, we publish something and they'll say that's too one-sided or something like that. And I always thank them, like, thanks for speaking up, because there are probably other people who agree with you who might hesitate from doing so. Just thinking about our own future in terms of working with the field, that's something that we are going to continue to work on, is how to solicit and raise up the diversities of views on issues like healthcare, what's the future of healthcare, or how do we deal with the opiate epidemic, or any number of health issues in communities where you know there's more than one point of view, and you want to make sure that you're not just favoring one over the other.
One approach may be, if you find the solution, if you find a high-performing, high-impact nonprofit organization in, you name the state, you name the metro area or rural town or suburban community, then work backwards. I think that we as foundations tend to want to go towards what are the foundations doing and not so much the reverse of what are the nonprofits doing and who is funding that work. And sometimes there may even be a great example and a great solution that isn't being funded by a private foundation. It may just be being funded by a federal opportunity or a corporate office or an individual philanthropist. So maybe, again, to go back and kind of shake up where we source our ideas from for these conversations, webinars, trainings, and panelists and whatnot could be a different approach.
That's a good point of view, because we are mostly working with the foundations, just as you point out. And we don't know what's going on in the ground. We're really relying on the funders to tell us about the exciting developments. But just as you're pointing out, there might be something going on that no funder is dealing with, but there's a lesson to be learned from that example.
And your close connection with the regionals may be able to help that out. They have oftentimes a palpable sense of what is occurring on the street and in their communities, and maybe they can help you kind of work backwards as well.
That's very interesting. I hadn't thought about that. So, Tim, I'm interested in how you would measure successful grant making. And here you can think about your past work, starting at St. Luke's and ending up at Potomac Health, all of the different foundations you've worked at. What are your thoughts about that?
It has been a challenge at all three foundations and the public health department that I worked at. I've had proprietary software created by academic institutions for a grant-making entity. I have used the mass-marketed, very popular products on the field, databases and such. And then I've also done Access and Excel sheets based on, you know, reports and information that grantees have submitted. And for me, you know, it's always qualitative and quantitative. It is being able to succinctly break it down to what has actually occurred, what lives have been impacted. For me, the biggest challenge is when you see that a grant isn't going right, and the end of the day product or service or intervention that X nonprofit was supposed to be offering hasn't occurred, didn't occur. What do you do with that information? And how do you make a better, more effective grant to that same agency the following year or to a different agency years later? And for me, it is honestly looking at the data, looking at the level of investment to the outcomes and outputs and objectives that have stemmed from that grant. And I know that, you know, this isn't corporate America and there isn't always one formula for cost-benefit analysis for grant making and foundations to do. But I think that, you know, there are very small foundations that don't have the dollars to bring in the evaluators and bring in the databases and the softwares and whatnot that study and track all of these outcomes and measures and do this data crunching and such. But I think that it doesn't have to be that heavy of an investment. If you have honest conversations and you have simple, straightforward, honest reporting forms and sheets for your grantees to submit, and just presenting to your foundation the information that they need and have, because I'm always afraid of the burden that it puts on the nonprofit as well. How do they source that information? Are they compliant with HIPAA regulations? what are they giving us that we're not going to do anything with? You know, there's a bunch of data at foundations across the country that nobody has crunched and done anything with, which also may be a missed opportunity. But and I think that when you can, to be able to work with academic institutions that have the statisticians and the numbers folks and epidemiologists that have the sense and the knack and how to do this work, and even some local health departments can be great sources of resources and partnership. That's one of the things the SAMHSA folks had told us at the event last year. You know, there really isn't one solution or one answer, but I think it's having honest conversations and really thinking strategically about what you're asking for from the grantees and why you're asking for it, and what are you going to do with that information when you have it.
When you think about outcomes, do you find that trustees ask the same questions or think about the same kinds of outputs as program staff? Do they look at it the same way or differently?
I think that oftentimes they look at it from the higher level in what their investments have leveraged, what conversations have maybe been started because of that grant or opportunity that they are looking at the data and the outcomes regarding. I think that sometimes they often don't understand the data that's being presented to them. And sometimes even the foundation staff that's presenting that information doesn't always necessarily understand it. So I think that the simpler that you can keep it, the more ground level that you can keep it. Bring in, of course, the experts and the guest speakers to your board meetings and the such. Oftentimes, people don't even ask their board, what kind of information do you want? What do you want us to report back on? And that's an honest conversation to have with them.
So one last question, Tim. I noticed that you have a Bachelor of Arts in English with creative writing. I love to write. I'm wondering if you still write, and if so, what do you write about?
I don't write often enough, nor do I even read often enough as much as I would want to. I have ideas for books, for teleplays in my head. At some point, I will put those pen to paper or start those keyboard strokes. I know who I want to play in the movie of my life.
Tell me more.
I would say for this age, a Jake Gyllenhaal kind of guy would be
totally
who I would go
it. Yes,
to.
Yes, I see it.
Younger, I think, you know, maybe a Zac Efron could play the college age one. I didn't have the body of Zac Efron back in 1997 in college, but personality-wise, I think that there are some similarities.
Now, in this movie, does health philanthropy play a part?
I think that health philanthropy does play a part. I've been in grant-making again, since 2004, I've worked for three foundations and a public health department. I've worked for hyper-local giving opportunities. I've also worked for a private family foundation that did quasi-national giving in 12 cities across the country where the family was involved with the foundation. And I've met a lot of persons and individuals and board members and nonprofit consumers from the Bronx in New York to Houston, Texas, in Florida, in D.C., in Virginia, Hawaii, all across the country. And when I look back upon the persons that I've met and the stories, I have shed tears probably in more site visits and nonprofits than I would want to actually admit. That's America. And that's America that I want to live in and that I'm trying to help out, find solutions for. So that will be part of the book.
Tim, this has really been a pleasure. Thank you so much for sitting with me for this past hour and sharing your thoughts and insights. I've really enjoyed getting to know you better. I'm really excited about your ideas for health philanthropy, and it's given me a lot of ideas about things that GIH can do, and I hope that listeners will have a similar experience.
Thank you so much for having me for this conversation. Just know that my door is open to continue the conversation, and happy anniversary to GIH.
Thank you. We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.